Good afternoon, welcome to the Committee on Transportation Policy and Finance. I call the meeting to order. Representative Sanders moves the minutes of April 4th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Members, we do have a pretty tight agenda today, so we're going to move things along quickly. And starting us will be House File 3652. And I will move House File 3652. And we'll move that to the general register. Representative Backer.
Yes, Chair, members, thank you. And it's an honor to bring this bill to you today. This bill would mark Trunk Highway 28 located between Beardsley and Graceville and designated as Staff Sergeant Kevin Witte Memorial Highway. Staff Sergeant Kevin M. Witte was killed in action serving our country on October 20th, 2006, while deployed in Baghdad, Iraq. He was a devoted soldier and who loved serving his country and did so with great pride. I'd like to turn it over to his stepmom, Rhonda, as to testify for the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for our committee record and continue with your testimony.
Is that yours?
My name is Rhonda Winker. I am...
That's okay. Go ahead.
Certainly. Take your time, please. Thank you for being here.
I'm Kevin Witte's stepmother. He was killed in action October 20th, 2006, while deployed serving his country in Baghdad, Iraq. I would like Highway 28 from Beardsley to Graceville. On June 12, 1998, Kevin joined the U.S. Army and completed basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. In July of 99, he reported to Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 504th Parachute, Infantry Regiment at Fort Bragg. In February of 2000, Kevin was reassigned to Echo Company, 313th Military Intelligence Battalion at Fort Bragg. He was deployed with his unit to Afghanistan in Operation Enduring Freedom in November of 2002 and to Operation Iraqi Freedom in November of 2003. He returned on assignment in August of 04 to Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 504th Parachute Infantry at Fort Bragg. He arrived in Baumholder, Germany on July of 2005 and served with Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 6th Infantry Regiment as a squad leader. He deployed December 14, 2005 as part of Task Force 2-6 Infantry in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom 5. His awards include the Army Commendation Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster, Army Achievement Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster, Army Valorous Unit Award, the Army Good Conduct Medal with Oak Leaf Cluster, National Defense Service Medal with Star Device, the Iraq Campaign Medal, Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal, the Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, the Army Service Ribbon, the Overseas Service Ribbon, the Combat Infantryman's Badge, Expert Infantry Badge, the Military Freefall Parachutist Badge, Basic and Army Parachutist Badge. And I can't say that word. After his death, he was awarded the Bronze Star Medal and the Purple Heart Medal.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Representative Backer?
Yeah, I just want to, on behalf of the family, ask for yes vote on this. We do appreciate the sacrifice that Kevin did for our country and his family.
Very well stated, and we thank you for your testimony. I know that's very difficult to be here. So with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3652 be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion is
Thank
approved.
You, members.
Okay. Representative Newton. We'll move to House File 2624. Representative Newton. Welcome, Representative Newton, to our committee. I will move House File 2624 to the General Register. Representative Newton to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a relatively simple bill. It provides that a military service member who's on active duty can retake a driver's test or driver's skill test without having to wait for the prescribed period of time, providing that they are either on orders being deployed or they're on leave from active duty in some place outside the United States, and they have a limited amount of time. In order to do this, the service member would have to prove that they are actually on military orders, and they could actually take a test the following day rather than have to wait.
Thank you, Representative Newton. Any questions from members? Anyone else in the audience would like to testify on this bill? Any further comments, Representative Newton?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, I will renew my motion. House File 2624 be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Approved. Thank you. So we do not see Eklund. Representative Eklund is there. Representative Eklund? Welcome, Representative Eklund. And I will, let's see, where are we? House File 3. I will move House File 3339 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Two-year bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And this is a pretty simple bill. It just authorized people that buy a lifetime hunting and fishing license to have it have some sort of endorsement put on their driver's license so they don't have to keep going in every year and renewing their license. It was heard in Mining and Outdoor Recreation yesterday, and we there's some concerns about the fiscal note on it.
Okay.
And we offered oral amendment to have it effective 2018, and that will give Department of Transportation and DNR a chance to do what needs to be done to make this happen. And I haven't met you yet, but I've got somebody from the Department of Transportation down here to talk about it.
Okay. Let's before we do that, let's clean that up. Like you said, with an oral amendment, we'll Mr. Lee, could you speak to that amendment for the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and members, the original fiscal note for the unamended bill before it was in Mining and Outdoor Heritage yesterday had a $486,000 cost to the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services. Part of that was associated with programming the legacy system before the MNLAR system is operational in 2018. With the delayed effective date, about $385,000 of those costs are eliminated. There's still some formatting changes that the department estimates to be at about $100,000 from the driver services account.
So, Mr. Lee, are you saying with that change and allowing for time for MNLARS to get up and running, that that would take care of the majority of that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And for those members who have sat on transportation for quite a while, you'll be okay with that, or you'll wonder whether MNLARS will be up and running to actually handle that fiscal note, but we will have to assume that that will be the case. Okay. Do we have an actual amendment then?
No, it was amended yesterday.
Oh, it was amended. Okay, thank you very much. And please state your name for the committee record and
sure.
Continue with the testimony.
My name is Don Olson. I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety.
And do you have testimony?
No, I'm more here to answer questions. If there's any questions about implementation or what the plans are for this bill. But I do want to reaffirm that we are working on that fiscal note right now that was expected to be delivered late this morning. And so from all indications, there would be no cost.
No cost. Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Norton.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I don't got that going. I want to ask a question that's not related to the driver's license, just so that I know what I'm voting on here. Can I do that? Representative,
sure.
So a lifetime game and fish license, do we currently have those and we're just adding it to the driver's license, or is this a new movement, and what happens if people violate, do things that are against DNR's positions regarding hunting and fishing, and it's on their license as a lifetime? Can that be taken away? I guess I'm just not really understanding this.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please state your name for the
members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Yes, we do sell lifetime game and hunting and fishing licenses. You get a lifetime hunting license, deer hunting license, a sportsman's license, an angling license. There's a whole different variety of them. Currently, we have about 30,000 that are sold statewide for the different varieties of licenses. The revocation piece, the bill itself would put that the label that you're the owner of this license on the owner of this lifetime license on the back of your driver's license. Our enforcement officers would still take that license and scan it, get the information. So if you were in violation, we would catch it at that point in time. The bill that's in front of you just puts on that identification that you own that license, similar to a firearm safety card or snowmobile safety, ATV training and safety are listed on the back of your license. So we would catch that and deal with that issue in the field. If the person had a violation, say a confis or a revocation of their hunting and fishing privileges for a period of years, it's not our intention to take their driver's license away just because it has that information on the back of it, but we would catch it through our records management system.
And so just to continue on, so if you could already get a lifetime game and fishing license, I don't understand why putting on the back of the license will keep you from having to get an annual renewal, which is kind of how it was stated. So I'm just not understanding the need for this. I mean, if you already give them, what do you gain by putting it on a driver's license? I'm not meaning to be difficult here. I'm just not understanding.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. Currently, if you have a lifetime game and fish license, you have to go into a bait store or sporting goods store every year and renew your, they print you out a new tag, new license that you carry in your wallet. The idea of this bill is so you don't have to do that. Yesterday, the assistant from the DNR came and we talked about reimbursement money too, and we got to figure out how to do that, but that should be done. But basically, it's just if a person goes out and makes an investment in a lifetime license, then they don't have to remember to go every year and get it renewed because they have it.
And so, Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding this would just mean instead of having a permanent card given, because it sounds like that would be an option, is just giving a permanent card to people when they got it. This is just streamlining.
Representative Beckman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, one less piece of plastic in your wallet.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, come here. Oh. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question along that line. Okay, so somebody doesn't have a driver's license, so they still have to do it year by year, that you don't have a permanent lifetime card?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think if it's in here, there's some issue about a Minnesota identification card, too, so it could be attached to that also. If they don't have that, then they would probably have to renew it every year.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eklund, just exactly how would that be designated on the driver's license? Would it be in print, or what are you?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, we're talking about something on the back of the card, and yesterday the thing on DNR came up. We didn't want to do that because that means do not resuscitate, but it would probably be a fish or a grouse or something like that the DNR would know. I apologize, Mr. Chair. The DNR would know what it means, and anybody else looking at your driver's license, it wouldn't make any sense to them.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, in our $1 bills, we have presidents up to, you know, Grant and Jackson, whatnot, on the back. Or when you designate that, could it have like a picture of maybe Tom Bach? Or would that be appropriate?
Any other questions for members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Representative Eklund, do you have any final comments on the bill?
Other than I think it's a rather simple bill that will make things more convenient, Mr. Chair, that it's the intent on this.
Thank you, Representative. I will renew my motion. House File 3339 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. And motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who's up?
He's got another bill.
Got another bill up. Sure. Representative Driskowski, are you? Are you? Okay.
Is it yours?
Okay. Representative Keel, if you are here, let's roll.
No.
Representative Keel, I will move House File 963 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means in two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the time to hear this bill. I do have to wondered if I could make a couple of oral amendments. The first one being on line 122. Right now it says the term includes longitudinal, and it should say the term does not include.
Is this your book?
I did.
And then The second one would be just on 2-7, and just to clarify that it's cable television, not cable vision, just to make sure we're clear on that. That would be the two simple amendments.
Representative Keel, where is that listed?
On
what line item?
2.7. Right now it says Cablevision.
2.7, do you have that? How come I don't have that?
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Just clarifying it.
I'm sorry, and what was it?
Cable television.
2.7 be cable television.
Okay. All right.
I apologize.
No problem. Members, I will move that oral amendment for line item 1.22 after the word term does not should be added, and include would be without the S. And on line item 2.7, the term would be cable television. Mr. Burris, do you have something to add?
Never mind, Mr. I think
we're okay. Okay. I'll move that oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Okay, that amendment is approved. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill actually came to me by way of my own cable company or my telephone communications company, and they were really struggling with trying to get a access to their city hall, and there was a little bit of challenges with the funds and the timing, because as you know, our construction season is very short, and after investigating this a little bit, realized there was a bill there, and so we put this together, and it would just give a little more stability to the telecommunications are actually utility companies, and then also get the timing in there. And but at this time, we have some other testifiers, and I think we will have them speak. I know we got a lot going on. So,
okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Christy Westbrock. Good afternoon, Chairman Kelly and committee members. I'm Christy Westbrock. I'm the COO at CTC in Brainerd, Minnesota. We're a local telecommunications cooperative providing voice, internet, and video services. We're currently installing broadband services throughout central Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to explain the importance of this bill to CTC. We are a 65-year-old telecommunications and broadband company with the history of serving areas where no one else will serve. CTC's service area spans nearly 1,000 square miles in north central Minnesota, serving about 12,000 members. Over the past year, 5 years, CTC has invested approximately $49.6 million in fiber to provide broadband through approximately 60% of those 1,000 square miles. In 2013 alone, we experienced 9 railroad crossings needed to complete the fiber optic installation. These 9 crossings resulted in total additional costs of $31,140 for the railroad licenses and for additional insurance costs that the railroad requires before they'll let us directionally bore under their railroad property. Under the current proposal, the railroad crossings would have cost CTC $6,750 instead of $31,140. This would have given CTC over $24,000 in additional funds, which could have been used to further build out fiber optics to provide high-speed broadband service, another pressing issue for Minnesota. As we look forward to the 2016 construction season, we're extremely concerned by these potential fees. CTC has plans of additional fiber optic infrastructure in rural Randall, Minnesota, just north of Little Falls. It is anticipated that we will have anywhere from 20 to 25 railroad crossings to complete construction. If this Senate file is unsuccessful, CTC is looking at additional costs in excess of $86,000 for those crossings based on our past practice, or we would incur $18,750 if the bill succeeds, which would be a savings of over $67,000, which again could be used for additional broadband infrastructure. Keep in mind, there is no minimal disturbance to any of the railroad right-of-ways when we use a directional boring method, which in all 2013 were used, and the 9 we plan for this summer will also be used. I thank you for this time and hope that you can move this forward.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Our association represents the 44 distribution cooperatives and the 6 G&Ts that provide them with power. This has been a big ongoing issue for cooperatives for years. Last appeared here in the legislature in the mid-90s when we were having problems with before. Legislation at that time established that the fees that are charged for crossings should be based on the diminished value of those crossings. And considering that we don't do anything to diminish the railroad's ability to use those rails, we were pleased with that. For the most part, for about a decade and a half, that kind of solved the problem for us. However, in the past few years, we've run into issues with the railroads doubling or tripling or, you know, sometimes increasing these fees tenfold. A few years ago in the Albert Lee service territory outside of Albert, or the Freeborn-Mauer cooperative service territory outside Albert Lee, we had one of the land agents for railroad ask for $40,000 for a crossing fee, which was identical to another crossing that was put in the year before, and they charged us $1,500 for it. One of the big issues and what we're trying to accomplish with this bill is that, you know, unlike other business negotiations, we can't walk away from these crossing fees because we have an obligation to serve everyone in our service territory. And in almost all the cases, we don't have another route to reach those customers except by crossing the railroad tracks. That kind of leaves us over the barrel in negotiations, and the railroads appear to understand this. Being Minnesota, we only have a short window for our construction season, and the railroads have no incentive to avoid delay and insist on these fees. We've heard from the railroads that they have concerns over safety from this bill. That is why we included the provision on that we would pay for any flag services that are required during the construction period. We also included insurance, the provision on insurance to alleviate some of their fears on that. And then we've also heard that the fee itself is arbitrary and doesn't cover their costs. We picked the $750 fee because that is what has been put into either statute in South Dakota. That was the also the figure that was that the Iowa Public Service Commission came up with as a fair fee for that. And I would also mention that in Wisconsin, in their administrative rules, they have fees of $150 for these types of crossings. So I appreciate you hearing this bill and the opportunity to speak on behalf of the cooperative, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Sarah Erickson, here today on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Rail Association. I apologize John Appetz couldn't be with you today. He's gotten very fond of testifying on railroad issues in front of your committee. The Minnesota Regional Rail Association is an organization of the 20 largest and smallest rail lines within the state. It has about 4,500 miles of track that it oversees. The railroads in the state have been responding to requests from utilities for over 100 years to run right away over their track. We currently already have a law in place to deal with disagreements between utilities and railroads over the fees requested for the use of railroad property. That law is very seldom used because these issues generally get worked out between the parties before it gets to that stage. What this bill does is create an entirely new procedure. It allows the utility to use the railroad right away with very little recourse by the companies who actually own the property. It also provides a huge discount to utilities when they decide they want to use that property, and this bill creates a number of concerns for us. We're concerned about the standards a utility might decide to use for engineering these crossings. We are concerned about the fact that a $750 fee doesn't begin to cover the cost of processing an application, surveying the site, filing the necessary legal recordings, and keeping track of the location of those crossings over the decades. We have a process that works about 99% of the time. We should continue to use that process and not create an entirely new one in law. I know that both sides have been working fairly diligently to come together to find some common ground on this. I don't think that we're quite there, and I would suspect, given some time, that you will see both sides continuing to work in that effort. I have two testifiers with me today. Ann Kennedy is a private attorney who works for the Union Pacific Railroad, and Brian Sweeney from the Burlington Northern Railroad.
Thank you for your testimony. And we appreciate the fact that we are working towards a solution here. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ann Kennedy. I'm an attorney and a certified real property specialist. I've been working with Union Pacific for more than 10 years on its real estate issues, including utility crossings. And I'm here today to talk to you about House File 963. So far, what we have heard today and in other hearings are examples of situations where utilities perceived fees being too high or processing time taking too long. Without understanding the context, though, it is really difficult to make an informed judgment about these particular examples. I'm going to take 30 seconds to tell you about Union Pacific's system, and I wanted to take that short time just so that I could try to convince you that the system isn't broken and doesn't need to be fixed. You can look online to see Union Pacific's processing procedures. That is the case with most railroads. You will see that 30 to 45 days is the prescribed time to process applications. You can see that engineering standards are carefully defined. They're according to an organization called AREMA, who establishes standards to protect railroad right-of-way. Let me jump into fees. fees charged by railroads typically fall into two categories. The first is administrative. Administrative includes engineering review, inspections on right-of-ways, both before, during, and after installation of a utility. And finally, these administrative fees are intended to cover the need to adjust books and maps to show the new utility facilities. It's important you can identify them later so they're not cut into or damaged when other facilities are put into place. Union Pacific charges a one-time fee for the land rights that utilities need to legally enter on private property, including railroad property. For Union Pacific, these fees are established based on appraisals, before and after appraisals. There is no typical fee, but you might give an example of $2,000 as a fee you would see. This process isn't any different than other processes followed when utilities place facilities over private property like farmland. And I know that no one here, I don't think anyone here would say that for example, a pipeline to be put across farm ground, that there's no compensation due the landowner for that installation on his or her ground. Bob Fox of the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority has previously testified against this bill, and I won't go into the details, but you can find that Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority has published online a very elaborate fee schedule. The application processing fee is $1,250. Fees range from, based on the type of installation, from city water, that's on the lower end of the spectrum, to the upper end of the spectrum, large petroleum or natural gas pipelines. Fees differ based on how much feet of crossing there is, how much actual occupancy there is. Those are just some of the examples of the ways fees can vary for these crossings. And so that leads me to the proposition that $750 as a standard frozen in place, one-time fee isn't adequate. It also doesn't take into account that when private property is taken and used for a public purpose, landowners are entitled to just compensation, determined through a fair process. This bill throws all of that out the window, and so railroads would be left with constitutional rights that aren't attended to. Just a flat fee of $750 doesn't satisfy those requirements. There are some federal preemption issues with the bill. Whenever railroad safety issues are in place, there is almost exclusive federal jurisdiction, so the PUC in many cases won't have the jurisdiction that's required, and the bill then will require time and resources for both parties to work their way through. I'm going to stop there now. I promise to be brief, and Mr. Sweeney, I'm sure, will have a few words to say.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. This issue, as was said, goes back about 20 years. It began with a legislator who couldn't understand why it was so expensive for his brother to run a power line to a barn he had just built. And so we worked together with the electric cooperatives, and we came up with a deal for BNSF where they had a one-time fee for small perpendicular crossings for the rural electric cooperatives of $750, and also some other changes in the terms of the crossing agreement. That deal was put in place recognizing that these are not for-profit organizations. $750 didn't cover our cost to process one of these applications 20 years ago. It certainly doesn't cover the cost today, not even for a basic crossing, let alone a much more complex crossing. For something such as an electric transmission line or a major pipeline, Keystone Pipeline crossing our tracks, for example, we would get $750 in 30 days notice and a drawing showing the location but not necessarily the design specifications of this facility. The next bill on the agenda is dealing with safety of shipment of hazardous commodities, and this bill gets into that area. It undercuts safety because of the lack of design standards, a lack of control in the application process for what design information we are given and the control we would have. Railroads use what are known as a REMA standard, American Railroad Engineering and Maintenance of Way Association. It's a whole different environment than any place else for building facilities. Since the 1920s, it's been documented that there's electromagnetic induction problems with power lines interfering with the signals in railroad systems. In fact, there's a place in South Dakota where the charge in the track was building up to the point that our people have to somehow use jumper cables and so on anytime they're working on that part of the track so that they don't get a shock. Directional boring was mentioned a couple of years ago in Washington State. A water company was doing directional boring without a permit. They went out, they bored, they hit a rock, pulled back the drill. They managed to take a double main line out of service for 3 days. We've had episodes on BNSF in the last several weeks. One in the state of Wyoming where an oil pipeline ruptured. It was not on our property, but it was adjacent to it. Caused some problems. We also had a situation where a contractor working on our property hit a natural gas pipeline that was located there. $750, and we have 30-day notice, little control over the specifications, potential interference with our signals, a massive liability exposure created. Comments was made earlier about the high cost of the insurance. That's because railroads are a unique situation. A general liability insurance policy doesn't apply to railroad property. It doesn't cover within 50 feet of the railroad, so you have to purchase what is known as railroad protective insurance. Otherwise, you don't have insurance for damage to the railroad. So it's essential that you have that. Also, because our employees are not covered by state workers' comp statutes, and so the general liability policy doesn't cover employee injury because of the assumption that there's workers' comp. Our people are under a tort-based system, the Federal Employers Liability Act. So if there's an injury, it's a tort-based deal. They sue us, or they will sue the other party, or we will sue the other party, depending on the circumstances. So it's imperative for their own protection that they have this insurance. We have a problem with the language that attempts to retroactively change contracts. We may have a long-term contract for use of several miles of our right-of-way involving substantial annual payments for a for-profit corporation. This says that once they've paid us $750 under this old agreement, they're done. They've got it from here on in for no additional fee, even though that was in the original agreement. I don't think the state can legally do that. So I'll try to cut it off there. This thing has a host of problems. They are safety related. They are property right related. And really do not recognize what's going on out there with in terms of the railroad engineering environment. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a couple of statements that have been said just recently that are trying to imply or infer the rationale for having different costs, and one of those has to do with, well, we need to know where the utilities are in order to tell people where the utilities and stuff are, except that here in Minnesota, anytime you do anything underground, at least, you're required to call Gopher One, which then contacts the utilities, and they will go on and mark that. So we need to make sure that we understand that everybody's on the same playing field when it goes to underground utilities as to where they're at, and it's not up to the responsibility of the railroads in order to maintain that. Now, they can if they want to, but that's their decision and not necessarily for the public safety issue. And the other one is also in regards to whether or not this particular utility that is going to laying it either underground or overhead, whether or not that's safe or whether or not there's a lot of other concerns about quality, would assume then that it would only go across railroad property. Because it goes across other property as well, that program has to be vetted out for many other agencies and requirements as well. So I'm a little bit concerned that we're trying to mislead a little bit that this only impacts railroads and that therefore the railroad has a higher stake in safety and utilities than the general public itself. And so I'm just a little concerned about some of the rhetoric that has been occurring here.
If I could respond to that, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Briefly, please.
We We do have costs involved in doing the engineering analysis and doing the insurance check and ensuring that they comply with standards. We have to have an engineer review to make sure that the location doesn't interfere with existing railroad equipment and infrastructure. As for the design, it's a different environment. Under the track, you have 286,000-pound cars going over these facilities on a continuous basis. For example, we require that pipelines be catheterized so that they are more resistant to corrosion. That's something that some of the companies are averse to doing. However, in the AREMA standards, that's essential when building a pipeline in railroad territory.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, are you trying to tell me that it costs the railroad $6,000 to allow a cable company to bore under your railroad right away? That it takes you, it costs $6,000 for you to process that permit application?
Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure if I understood what was said, because I thought there was a $6,000 estimated total cost versus the $30,000 cost, or whatever the larger number was. But when it comes to the cost of crossings, depending on the circumstances, the location, and whatnot, yes, it could. And also included in that cost was the insurance requirement. I'm not sure how much of that cost is reflective of the insurance. And again, they have to have that insurance, or else they don't have insurance at all for anything occurring with the railroad.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Sweeney, I don't have any question. I mean, you talked a number of things that don't even apply. You talked about people working without a permit, activities not on the property. But you folks need to get realistic in charging somebody $6,000 for a cable company to bore under your right-of-way. You've created a bureaucracy. More often, all we hear from people is, you know what, I'd rather deal with all the government agencies than the railroad. And you wonder why you're here? You're charging somebody to punch a cable under your right-of-way, $6,000? You guys create a lot of trouble for yourself, Mr. Sweeney. I don't think testifying against this bill and trying to justify the way you're gouging us is right. I think that you should get a little more realistic. You're talking about all kinds of things, working without a permit, not on our property, contractors that did this, having the right amount of insurance. I realize they better have a lot of insurance if they're going to punch under your right-of-way. I don't have any problem with that. But I don't think trying to justify and having the attorneys come down here and talk the language that's way beyond all of us about justifying what you do, you're creating an atmosphere where people question everything you do now by trying to justify exorbitant fees like this. I do suggest you work with Representative Keel and get realistic before we legislate. I'd like to change it to $150 instead of $750. You ought to be able to go online and look on your computer and see it's okay for them to punch the cable on, and you know it's going to be on there forever with the electronic data today. So justify some ongoing cost and all that. You're just, it doesn't look right, Mr. Sweeney. I think it would be better to pick your battles.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is more just a comment. I know that there's this back and forth about fees, but it was mentioned by both Mr. Johnson and Mr. Sweeney some safety issues. So my understanding is that the parties are going to try to work this out, headed to Ways and Means, and I just want to really emphasize that if there are safety concerns here, that those be adequately addressed moving forward. I was not aware of this. I mean, this is this electromagnetic power lines interfering with signals is of great concern. So, you know, again, I hope these issues will be addressed.
Thank you. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a couple basic questions. Number one is, how often does the current system work? That's the one thing neither party covered. I mean, have there been 500 of these in the last year and it's worked only 100 times? I don't know if that's for you, Representative Keel, or for whom? Or Mr.
Representative Keel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I didn't ask that question. That's a good question.
Is there somebody there?
Apparently we don't have a number.
And I'll take it as Mr. Johnson comes down that, you know, nobody seeks legislation as a first resort, right? I mean, there's...
Correct.
I'm not suggesting that there's not an issue, but Mr. Johnson, do you happen to know? I mean, is it 10 times a year that we...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, in the past year, we've tried to resolve probably about a dozen of these. Those are up significantly from previous years, but generally we will see most of these we're able to solve the issue by calling Mr. Sweeney or another representative from the railroads. Typically, if we can't get some type of movement towards a more reasonable fee, what will happen is we will the utility will send a letter to the railroad saying that they want the Department of Commerce to determine what the fee will be, which is an option that we have. And typically then that usually is enough to get the fee down to $750. It hasn't been in the past couple of years. And we've also seen, you know, you have to balance then what the cost is going to be to in your assessment at the Department of Commerce with the legal fees versus what the railroad is asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Jensen. Just one more question, and you answered my third question. Is there a shot clock? In light of its basketball season, is there a period of time that the railroads have to respond, or is it an indefinite period of time?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, under current statute, the utility can commence construction immediately unless the railroad raises a significant safety issue over that specific crossing. But again, the problem for the that we're finding is when we are trying to negotiate, these negotiations are stretching out longer and longer. We had several in the past year that exceeded 4 months before we got resolution. And you know, as you know, here in Minnesota, our construction season is, you know, that takes up a great deal of that. You know, 4 months really eats into that.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we've got a heavy agenda. I actually have several more questions that I'm not going to ask today, but I did. Ms. Erickson made the point. The Representative Keela made the point. Everybody's made the point. The Chairman has made the point about you got two giants of industry here that ought to be able to figure this out, that have a long history of working this stuff out. And if it gets to the floor and it hasn't been worked out, I think I won't be the only one with a lot more questions. So I urge both sides to try to figure it out. The 750 fee, this would be my one editorial comment, to set that arbitrarily in statute, whether it's maybe Representative McNamara is right at 150, but I doubt that that covers for time immemorial the cost of processing and surveys and legal and so forth. And to dictate a number, whether it's 750 or 2,000, doesn't seem to make a great deal. That seems to me like it was a shot across the bow to get the attention of the railroads. But I certainly urge you, and I'm optimistic that you'll be able to talk and figure something out before this thing gets to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, and we have reached out to them and tried to kind of work this through for the past year and a half, several years actually. And this is where we're at now, and we're hoping that this will be a real impetus to sit down and discuss this seriously.
I bet it will.
Well, we have a couple of weeks. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, then I will renew my motion that, where are we? House File 963 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as amended, right? House File 963 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Drozdowski. Representative Drozdowski moves House File 3723 be passed and sent to the General Register. And Representative Drozdowski, to your bill, I know we heard this on Monday. I appreciate you going back and working on this. And what's the report back?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a productive 2 days, and I'm glad we laid it over and did some of the work on the bill in committee instead of waiting to go to the floor to do that. So I think it was smart for us to lay the bill over. I have an amendment, Mr. Chair. It's an A2 amendment that reflects what we have done to accommodate a lot of the issues raised by the counties and townships
at the last meeting, and I have an oral amendment to that as well. So, Mr. Chair, if I could move the A2 amendment to the bill.
Representative Joskowski moves the A2 amendment. Do you want to add the oral amendment right now? What is the oral amendment to it?
I could do that.
We'll incorporate the oral amendment right now.
All righty. The oral amendment is on page 1, line 9 of the amendment, of course. Delete abutting the right-of-way of and inserting may, comma, with respect to. And then also on page 1, line 10, delete the word may. So it would read, Mr. Chair, a property owner or occupant of property may, with respect to a county highway, including a county state aid highway or town road, temporarily place a pressurized flexible force main for the transport, and all the way to the end of the sentence.
Okay. Representative Joskowski moves the A2 amendment, incorporating that oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. An amendment is adopted. Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment, members, and Mr. Chair, provides some certainty for local units of government in that we are suggesting, or actually expressly saying in the amendment, that it needs to be a person who is certified and is a certified manure applicator. The Department of Agriculture has a certified program that we have given them to carry out in the past, and they're carrying it out. It provides for notice to the townships and counties so that the landowner or the manure applicator will call or notify them in writing of the fact that they are bringing forward the flex force pipe into the right-of-way, including the starting and ending dates of application, the description of the length of the right-of-way being used, and the name of the commercial business or business or commercial animal waste technician operator license holder. So it addresses that. It also addresses, through doing it this way, Mr. Chair and members, the question of liability, in that a commercial animal waste technician must have insurance or financial responsibility, has to furnish proof of financial responsibility under 18C.430, which would include proving net assets equal to greater than $50,000 or performance bond or insurance of the kind and amount determined by the Commissioner of Agriculture. It also includes, Mr. Chair, the acquisition of a commercial animal waste technician includes going through a training course. Again, according to 18C.430, that is carried out by the Commissioner of Agriculture with the Extension Service, includes an application fee, last 12 months. The training needs to focus on water quality protection, development of manure management plans for them. It also needs to include specific current regulatory concerns, so certainly these concerns and how to notify the units of government would be included in that training that the Extension Service and Department of Agriculture would carry out. They're also required to update the training manuals and the examination that goes with the training to include manure management practices that discuss prevention of manure occurrences in waters of the state. So, Mr. Chair, I'm very comfortable with what we have in front of us to provide the clarity and to address certainly the two main concerns that were brought up the other day, that being providing notice to the township so that they don't run over the hose or the lawnmower, and provide liability, and also certainly this makes certain that we have people who are well trained on current regulation and water quality protection are the people who we are providing this ability in statute to carry out. This discussion, Mr. Chair, and I'm hopeful that it's clear that the manure applicator is liable for that pipe and what happens around it, and that's what the intention of this approach is, and I think it provides a good solution in this particular bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members?
Mr. Chair, I'll add that this doesn't completely take care of all the concerns of the townships and counties. I think we're much, much closer. They still have some concerns. We'll continue to have discussions with them between here and the floor and work with them to the extent we can.
Mm-hmm. Are there any members of the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee and continue with your testimony. We are going to be moving this along, so if you could keep it brief, we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Ken Stallone with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I'm not going to get into the discussion that we had the other day. We do appreciate Representative Druskowski's efforts to try to address a few of the issues, as well as the conversations we are having primarily with the milk producers, trying to seek common ground on this. However, we are still in opposition to the bill as amended. It is a complete preemption of local control. There is no local government oversight permitted whatsoever. It does clarify that the hoses are allowed in the right-of-way, but does not provide us with any ability to have local oversight and to address other concerns. So with that, we must still oppose the bill, but we do commit to keeping conversations going with Representative Druskowski and the proponents of the bill in hopes that perhaps something can arise.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members, Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. We want to thank Representative Druskowski for the continued conversation on this bill. We continue to support the law as is. We support the technology, but also support the clarity that the current law provides in terms of permitting. And so with that, I want to keep my comments brief, but we appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of the 10 Greater Minnesota Regional Center counties and four counties here in the suburban area. We also want to thank Representative Druskowski and the proponents for continuing to have dialogue with us regarding our concerns with this bill. As indicated by the previous two testifiers, we still do oppose this bill at this time because it does not explicitly give us the permitting authority that exists under current law. I think you saw with Representatives Keels how important control over our right-of-way is, regardless of whether we're talking about a public road authority, a railroad, over our rights-of-way. Our rights-of-way right now, we are explicitly required to provide public utilities access to those for moving their lines or pipelines, but they are required to get a permit from us to do construction and also for the placement of any structures, lines, poles, and pipelines that they place upon that right-of-way. So we're frankly asking no more from these operators of the forest mains than we are was currently required of the pipeline authority. Not only is this a issue with regards to our mowing, it's also a safety consideration. Under the design standards that are applicable to us, we are required to maintain a safety zone or what's called a recovery zone under the standards. And that does, depending on the width of the ditch, extend up the back slope of the ditch. And consequently, we don't permit the utilities to put their poles, et cetera, in those recovery zones, and we don't want to set the precedent of allowing these forced mains to be done in the ditch. Our greatest concern, frankly, is that this is setting a precedent. Right now we have this technology for manure, but certainly we can foresee the possibility that this technology will be used for moving the product itself, whether we're talking about grain or corn or possibly wood pulp up in the northern portion of our state. So we have great concerns about the precedents that being set here. I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall from our last discussion that, I mean, that all the testifiers, you support the new way of moving it. There hasn't been any disagreement about that. And you even acknowledge, at least I recall with the townships, that some townships may just say, we have no problem with this. You don't have to go through a process. But it just retains some local control over what's at issue here. And so
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, you captured our thoughts on that explicitly. We have been working with the proponents of this bill to say that explicitly. If the township or the county does not decide to explicitly permit, then it's allowed. If we do want to exercise our permitting authority, if they reach the comport with the explicit requirements of the law, then we must issue the permit. All we want is to basically maintain control over our right-of-way have notice in those situations where we feel we need it.
And so, Mr. Chair, I guess just in summary then, it's confusing because it feels like big state government is coming along and taking away local control of an issue. And this is confusing to me why we're moving in this direction.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Hausman, I think some of us would argue that the local control is, in this case, the mineral applicator and the farmer, and that the local government is just that, another unit of government between the most local control, which is our businesses and our families in the state of Minnesota. So to the extent that we can minimize the encumbrances that they may place upon them within the limits of the public interest, I think the better. And so that's why this approach is the preferred approach.
Other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Drazkowski renews his motion at House File 3723 as amended. Be passed and referred or sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
This is interesting.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Hamilton, and I will move House File 3325, and that be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And please present your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In essence of the time, I'm just going to say this is probably one of the coolest bills you're ever going to see in front of your committee. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and continue your testimony.
Chair Kelly, members of the committee, my name is Laylee Fadahi, and I represent the citizens group Self-Driving Minnesota, which is a group that's dedicated to ensuring that the development of self-driving cars increases the liberty and the autonomy of the millions of Minnesotans with disabilities, as well as older Minnesotans who are currently unable to drive. What House File 3325 does, it works at the nexus of advancing Minnesota's position in the $1.3 trillion global market for self-driving vehicles and creating an opportunity for industry to develop innovative solutions to address some of the transportation needs of individuals with disabilities. And as you'll hear from some of the testifiers today, lack of independent mobility is a profound obstacle that impedes the liberty of many people with disabilities to access education, health care, employment, and to participate in many aspects of community life. And in addition to the losses of freedom, there's also millions of dollars that are lost every year in terms of foregone work, volunteer hours, consumer spending, and increased health care and institutional housing costs associated with poor transportation independence. Essentially, the issue is that self-driving Technology is rapidly advancing. It's anticipated fully autonomous vehicles to reach market sometime between 2020 and 2035. However, overall, the speed of the technology is outpacing that of the policy, our assessment of the policy climate, which may, in many instances, inhibit the ability of the technology to advance. I'll walk you quickly through the bill. Section 1 of the bill provides a definition for autonomous vehicles for the purposes of this act, meaning fully autonomous vehicles that do not require active control or monitoring by a human operator. Section 2 of the bill establishes an autonomous vehicle task force that is comprised of geographically balanced representation from the legislature, the departments of public safety, transportation, and commerce, the Minnesota State Council on Disability, the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and several members of the public. And what that task force will do is two things. The first is it will prepare a report of findings and recommendations to the legislature on how self-driving cars can provide safe and cost-effective transportation solutions for people with disabilities across Minnesota. And second, it will direct a technology demonstration project that is described in Section 3 of the bill to procure, develop, and ultimately pilot fully autonomous self-driving car technology in Minnesota with participants having a range of different types of disabilities. And then subdivision 4, which starts on line 4.1, that provides the authorization and the conditions under which people who can't currently hold a driver's license can participate in the technology demonstration. Yes, and then we also have an amendment. This is the A1 amendment that was put together by House Research that provides, I think, what are just some technical clarifications of the language, and I'm happy to read that if you like.
Thank you. I will I'll also move the A1 amendment, Representative Hamilton, to put it in the shape you would like that. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, answer by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Okay. Amendment is adopted.
No, that's not what that is. What we need to do is take Section 3 subdivision 5.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if you have another author's amendment up there, but I don't know if it'd be appropriate. I know you're going to be holding this over. No, you're passing this on. If I can make have somebody make an oral amendment, subdivision 5, it would be on lines 4.11, and that's the liability piece, and we agreed to take that out, and therefore we didn't go to civil law. So if we could take that out in this committee, Mr. Chairman, it'd be lines 4.11 through 4.16.
Okay. I will move that oral amendment, Representative Hamilton, to delete subdivision 5. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. That motion is also adopted.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I believe we have one more testifier.
Please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. We're a small state agency that focuses on disability issues as an advisory agency to Minnesota government. Got copies of my testimony. I'll send that out because I'm going to do the shortened version so you can have the longer version and read at your leisure. So autonomous vehicles hold tremendous potential for people with disabilities and seniors who currently lack equal access to transportation. When the needs of those with a variety of disabilities, including blindness, are considered during the development of transportation innovations, everybody benefits. It was just in the last couple of weeks that the National Council on Disability actually testified before Congress about autonomous vehicles. So it's certainly on the horizon, so this is a great time for Minnesota to be looking into this option. So why are self-driving vehicles, cars, important to the 57 million Americans with disabilities and the 20% that actually live here in Minnesota? Autonomous vehicles, or AVs for acronyms, hold great potential to advancement in social inclusion by offering people with a variety of disabilities, including blindness, independent mobility to get to school, jobs, and participate
in what all the other Americans get to do and just take for granted. This is also a possibility of ending isolation for many seniors. Also, autonomous vehicles are going to help increase the employment opportunities for people with disabilities, since our employment rate is at an all-time low of 68%. Autonomous vehicles holds the key for independent use of vehicles by people who cannot hold a driver's license. However, without explicit inclusion of accessibility in the development of autonomous vehicle technology, the potential for independence decreases. And there is one lesson we can learn from many instances through the ADA, and that is with web development. People with low vision or blind were not considered when they develop many of the websites, and so the autonomous vehicle technology needs to take great lesson and learn here to make sure we don't have those same issues as we move forward. Bottom line is we really think that the autonomous vehicles could really help the state of Minnesota in actually maybe purchasing a fleet of autonomous vehicles to be used with Department of Human Services, Department of Transportation, and even Veterans Administration. Many huge areas of potential of saving money here. By supporting this bill, Minnesota will be actually in the driver's seat to help push for full accessibility on autonomous vehicles nationwide. And finally, there are many members of the disability community who have expressed their concerns that this technology will develop in a way that won't be affordable or accessible to them. So we want to make sure we do it right here in Minnesota and nationally, and that's why this task force is going to be a huge opportunity for everyone to make sure it's accessible for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, my third and final testifier.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and continue with testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Charlene Dahl, and I live in Anoka County in Columbia Heights. I am excited about the driverless vehicle. I actually lost my job in North Chicago, Illinois, at the VA Medical Center because Metro Mobility changed their accessibility times and I couldn't get to my job. I wasn't ready to retire after 27 years. I had a few more to go to take care of our vets. This bill would bring us into a whole new world where people like me wouldn't lose their jobs because we can't get to them. I can't express how important that is for those who are behind me, who are working now, who risk something changing where they can't get to their job. It is my hope and prayer that this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions by members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill?
I'm going to try to be real quick. Bob again, Carney Jr., I understand how time-pressed this is. I was at the Senate hearing on this. It went about an hour. Very good discussion. Really, this is just nowhere near an adequate amount of time to consider this. You're talking about spending $5 million. The reality is this is part of a bigger puzzle. How does transit and transportation fit together? How do you coordinate what MnDOT does with what CTIB and Metro Transit does? I strongly suggest that this bill does not need to pass this session. The fact that it's been introduced and it's being discussed is great, but $5 million for solving one piece of the puzzle doesn't make sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Hamilton, any final comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, I disagree with the last testifier. But aside from that, you heard the testimony. We had some very compelling testimony. This is now. You know, people talk, Mr. Chairman, I'd simply ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3325, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
My kid wants to go to a friend's house. Can I just put him in the car and go?
Did you get your suit for the bell?
Yeah.
We are going to take up House File 2690. And with that, Chairman Kelly, I think you are ready to move your bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2690. I also have an oral amendment. Members, the oral amendment would change the acted date to 2017 instead of 2016. We did receive a fiscal note back on that, and our system of MNLARS is back to back in the equation here, and what the department says, if they're allowed time for that to get up and running, then that will reduce the fiscal note to zero. So that's why we're moving that. And Mr. Chair, the oral amendment would be page 2, line 21, delete 2016 and insert 2017. On page 4, line 34, delete 2016 and insert 2017. Page 5, line 25, delete 2016 and insert 2017. And finally, on page 6, line 12, delete 2016 and insert 2017.
Okay, so just to recap, on four pages 2, 4, 5, and 6, references of 2016, or you're changing that to 2017?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Everybody clear on that oral amendment? It's basically just changing the dates for those. If not, all in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That amendment is now on bill, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, we already saw this bill in another format. Representative Norton and I both presented this bill. Representative Norton did in our committee. We both presented in the Public Safety Committee. Certainly, it's changed since that. From this bill makes ignition interlock mandatory after the second offense, whereas the first bill was going after the first offense. So that is the change in the bill from committee to here. In hearing some of the arguments against and working towards trying to become having this become a stiffer penalty, which I'm absolutely in favor of. I was in favor of it when Representative Norton brought the bill, but also understanding that, as we've seen today, working through compromise and wanting to get bills done and bills passed and a move towards making it more difficult to drive while impaired. That is the reason that this bill is in this format right now. And with that, I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, Chair Kelly, would you like to redo your motion?
I would. I'd like to move that House File 2690 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And it is moving on. I believe we are going next to Representative Chair Hornstein. This would be House File
3698. It is going to We have some oral amendments.
Representative Hornstein, I understand we have some oral amendments.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. And we'll be working off the DE3 amendment, and I believe the motion is that this would go to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Representative Hornstein.
So, Mr. Chair, House File 3698 is now reduced to the DE3 amendment. We had a number of provisions in here that were important, but we just didn't have the time to get all of those fully vetted. So this really just deals with the transportation-related issues that would be appropriate for us to deal with in our committee. And so we just have a couple of small, I have one small oral amendment. I understand Representative Uglem will have maybe a couple others later. But we want to get this bill in a shape to move on. And it does represent some compromises that, you know, a number of the stakeholders have made. So, I really appreciate the conversation I had with Representative Uglem about this. So, Mr. Chair, the oral amendment I would like to offer is on page 1, line 8, and line 9. We would delete the new language up to 9 and then replace that with 2 additional. And I can explain the rationale for that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein, yes, to that.
So this deals with increasing the number of state track inspectors. The reason we're looking at this really had to do with some testimony that we had before this committee back in February. We had an interim hearing. MnDOT presented some information about their track inspection program and the number of violations, over 2,000 violations, 12 of them major. And there was some discussion at that hearing, bipartisanly actually, about the need to increase inspectors. So instead of, this was permissive language originally to go up to 9, but again there were some concerns about that number. And MnDOT in previous testimony has outlined some specific rules for 2 additional inspectors, so hence we are changing it back down to 2, you know, up to 9. Would have, I think, added 5 additionals, potentially. But now we're going down to 2.
Okay. Representative Horsey, would you like to move that right now?
Yeah.
Okay, could you repeat the amendment?
Yeah, so the oral amendment is to delete up to 9 in lines 8 and 9 on page 1 and replace it with 2 additional. I hope, I think Mr. Burris understands what I'm trying to do, but I always like to make sure that it makes sense.
Okay. Representative Hornstein moves the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. This is the oral amendment to the DE3. We want us to adopt it first.
Mr. Chair and members, by my records, the DE3 hadn't been moved yet.
Okay.
And so I'd recommend moving the DE3 as the initial step.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burris.
The amendment could either be orally incorporated into the DE3 or
okay. It
could be as a separate oral amendment that's adopted independently.
Okay. Representative Hornstein moves the DE3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Amendments adopted. Representative Hornstein also moves an oral amendment that deletes the or adds, excuse me, what was the actual? Do you have that, Mr. Burris?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment would be page 1, line 8, delete up.
Okay.
Page 1, line 9, delete 29, and insert 2 additional, TWO additional.
Okay. All those in favor of that oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Thank you. Representative Hornstein, please.
Thank you, Mr.
Proceed.
Chair. Just very briefly, so what the DE3 amendment and House File 3698 now are looking to do is to continue the work that we've done in the legislature over the last 3 years on oil, ethanol, and hazardous rail safety issues. And so in addition to adding a couple of additional inspectors, and that's really because traffic is increasing along the system, and we know these inspectors are effective in doing their job, and this is a preventative step so that we don't have to face the kind of derailments and fires and other potential problems that occur with transportation of these materials. So we've added the new inspectors, and then in the second section we are looking at some additional transparency issues. There were questions that came up after the hearing again in February from first responders, and so we worked with them to craft some additional language that would provide more information to first responders about this issue. So I know time is tight. We have a number of short testifiers, but that's the bill at this point. Again, a much more scaled back version of the original bill, but a one that I think we can come to consensus on and move forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum.
Over here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of small oral amendments also that Representative Hornstein and I have discussed that I think will make the bill a little clearer. On page 3, line 31, delete everything after transported and insert a semicolon. And on page 3, delete line 32. This oral amendment basically hazardous materials are identified in federal law and further up in line 3-8. So at any rate, it's redundant. It's not necessary. And the language, as you can see there, is not correct in terms of gravity. It should be specific gravity and so on and so forth. So we'll delete those.
Burris, would you like to repeat that amendment to us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment would be page 3, line 31, delete everything after transported and insert a semicolon. Page 3, delete line 32.
Thank you. All those in favor of that oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
Mr. Chair, I have one other oral amendment. And that would be on line 4, or page 4, rather, last page, delete lines 4, 5, and 6. This provision is contained further up in the bill in subdivision 3.
Okay. Representative Uglum was oral amendment to delete lines on page 4, 4.4, 4.5, and 4.6. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Our amendment is also adopted. Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I think we have some members of the first responder and emergency management community and a couple of concerned citizens that are interested in testifying. I know from my side, I know there's others that are interested. So I think everyone knows to be brief, Mr. Chair. So.
Absolutely. Thank you. Please state your name for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, good afternoon. My name is Eric Waggy, and I'm here representing the 450 members of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and I'm also the Director of Emergency Management for Hennepin County. I'm joined here by my colleague, Rick Larkin, Emergency Manager of St. Paul. You'll be hearing from many of my colleagues in the fire service. Minnesota law requires that jurisdictions set up an emergency management organization and appoint an emergency management director like me. Our responsibilities are to plan for emergencies that are complex enough to overwhelm local fire, law enforcement, and emergency medical response capabilities. We ensure that our local jurisdictions are as ready as possible to deal with disasters in order to preserve life and property in Minnesota. A big part of our job is to make sure that our local emergency response crews are not taken by surprise. To do this, we catalog the hazards we face. We look for vulnerabilities, we inventory our capabilities, and we identify the gaps that could cause problems for our response. Accurate and complete information is the most vital resource needed to improve our ability to deal with disasters. Missing information creates a serious weakness in our ability to plan. In disaster response, it's really all about the planning that we get done beforehand. When a train derails in your town on a cold winter night and releases deadly anhydrous ammonia, responders must come as they are. They are either ready or they're not. We increase our odds of success through prior assessments, coordination, equipping, and training. And I've been in that circumstance with that anhydrous leak in the middle of the night. I'm here today because the emergency managers of Minnesota have found that there's a significant information gap for a major hazard that many of our communities face, which is the bulk rail shipment of hazardous materials through the heart of our communities. In a survey of Minnesota County emergency managers taken last July, not one respondent possessed or had ever seen a copy of a railroad emergency plan. Now that has improved slightly since then, but we've asked railroads for written plans under the authority granted us by this legislature previously, and we were sent plans that did not measure up. These fell into three main types. The first type was generic response concepts, which were nationally based and too vague to be of local use. The second was heavily redacted plans missing a lot of key information. And the third was information that was highly restricted by non-disclosure agreements that made planning with anybody else virtually impossible. So at this point, I'm going to draw a clear distinction between planning information and response information. Planning information is the data that we need well ahead of time to assess hazards, vulnerabilities, risks, and capabilities. This is what the emergency managers are here asking for. Specifically, we want the rail risk analysis that the federal government requires the railroads to prepare, including all 27 points of assessment. Response information is vital too, but it is quite different. Response information involves pieces of information that a responding emergency crew needs to know immediately when they arrive on a scene. This might be the contents of and hazards of a particular rail car that's on its side, for example. Response information has immediate but temporary value. Planning information has detailed and localized data but has lasting value on which all of our coordination, equipment, training, and resource decisions are based. I ask that you keep in mind that the Ask Rail app that you will probably soon hear more about is clearly a response tool but not a planning tool. It's also finally important that I remind you of what should be obvious but often gets overlooked, and that's despite any other regulation or authority that may be out there. It is always the people in the fire trucks, police squads, and ambulances of local jurisdictions who will actually have to face an emergency. Locals lead the response, they conduct the evacuations, they rescue the trapped, they treat the injured, and they bring order to the scene. This is the foundation of emergency response in the United States. It just doesn't happen that federal fire trucks are going to show up on your scene because of the fact that responses are local. County and city emergency managers are here because we know we can't rely on just informal discussions with the railroads on these plans, and we can't depend on occasional handovers of spotty information. We believe that it's critical to public safety that we make sure that detailed and localized emergency planning response information gets pushed down to emergency responders at that layer of government in an organized, consistent, and deliberate way. Your emergency managers are sending a warning that without this access, both our responders and our communities are certainly less safe. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rick Larkin. I'm the Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul. I'm here in addition to my colleague, Eric Waggy, who is 2 years previous past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, our current president from Otter Tail County, Mr. Patrick Beletsko, sends his greetings and support. And the reason I'm telling you that is because I want the committee to understand that this is not a St. Paul Hennepin County issue. This is a statewide issue. This is the number one item of support in our association platform. So every single representative here has back home an emergency management director who is trying to keep your citizens safe. I'd like to just illustrate Mr. Waggy's point about the three types of information we get. Before I do that, I do want to say that the railroads are good people. They do provide jobs to our local economy. They do provide services that run across our country and keep our country vital. We are trying to be their partner, and we need them to join us in the safety of your citizens. Without calling out the particular railroad, I want you to know that I've requested all three Class 1 railroads that operate in the city of St. Paul, much like my colleagues have across the state. We received plans. However, under the local emergency response plan, this is what I received. The good news is that it's double-sided. So, and I'm trying to be very respectful, and I do believe their efforts are sincere. And their desire to work together with us is sincere. What we're asking is that you would place into law, because maybe the sincere people that we've heard from are not going to be around next year. Maybe I'm not going to be around. I'd like to tell our emergency managers in your home districts that yes, as you are professional responsibility to keep your community safe, you have access to this information. We share the concerns about security of information, but we're on the right side. So help us, if you would, please. And I'll refrain from the rest of my prepared testimony and stand at questions.
Sir, if you want to continue with your testimony, we're going to have to come back at 6 o'clock anyway, so since you've been here, if you want to continue with your testimony, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity, but I think my colleague covered it well, and I want to give Chief Piper a good opportunity to talk about the fire response, because emergency management is well represented, but I do appreciate the opportunity. Out of respect for the committee, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. John Piper, Coon Rapids Fire Chief, representing the Fire Service of Minnesota. Also in the audience, Fridley Fire Chief John Berg, and Dale Specken from Hopkins, and State Fire Marshal Bruce West. So that's they're also here to hear what we have to say. I'm going to address the software portion of it, the Ask Rail portion of it. Basically what that is an app that we can get information on our smartphone. In other words, we get to the scene and there's an overturned car. We can identify by punching in the number. We can find out what's in the car, if there's something in the car, and then go from there. The issue is that many of the fire trucks have laptops which are web-based. So really the important thing that on this issue is we need the application to be web-based. So we can access it from our vehicles. As far as the smartphones, we discourage our firefighters from taking the smartphones with them. We've already had one get destroyed, and guess what? Then the city got a bill for it. So point being is that's why we're asking the application to be web-based. And as a point of information, all we're asking for on that application is what's in the car, if there's something in the car. It has nothing to do with the other information that the two previous testifiers talked about. That information, there's a lot of sensitive information there, and we are not requesting that be accessible web-based from AskRail. Regarding the information that was discussed a couple of moments ago, we respond to a wide variety of calls. When we get to the call, we have to understand what are we dealing with. Once we understand what kind of a call we have, then we have to decide, well, what resources are available, what resources are we going to have to use to take care of the issue. So basically, what are the equipment, what personnel, what expertise is available? And most of the time, that's pretty routine for us. I mean, we go to a heart attack, we got EMTs take care of that, we have a house fire, it's pretty routine. In the event of a rail emergency, it's a significant event, and the railroads play a major, major role in the outcome. We need to know, as you just heard a minute ago, what are their emergency plans? What equipment are they bringing? What personnel? What is the expertise of the personnel? When is it going to arrive? We need that information to come up with a game plan to address what would be a major incident pretty much anywhere in the state of Minnesota. Put it into perspective, one of my coworkers, Captain Mark Seaton, he's one of our three primary incident commanders. I had a visit with him because he's been to Pueblo, Colorado. We've sent four people out there for that training. He's also one of our three certified emergency managers here in the state of Minnesota. And I asked him about it, and basically, as you've heard a couple times now, the information that I just mentioned, we need that information. We need to know who's coming from the railroad, what are they bringing, what is their expertise, and when are they going to get there. We need that information up front so we can plan what we're going to do. I mean, he summed it up. It's very difficult to develop a comprehensive action plan when you don't know what the railroad will be bringing to the scene. In fact, I'm going to cut short also in the interest of your time. I'll close by saying it's the fire department's responsibility, not only in Coon Rapids, but in every one of your communities also, to protect the citizens and the visitors from the adverse effects of various types of emergencies that they may encounter. This involves planning, training, and knowing what resources are available for us to deal with these situations. Today, Captain Seaton is working in our city, and as I visited with him before I came over here, he said basically, and this is his words, since he doesn't know what resources the railroad will bring, he will not be relying on them for anything. That's not a good situation. It's really not a desirable position for myself or any other community, and frankly, I'm not comfortable with that position. So with that said, I will just say the proposed legislation before you allows us to get the information we need to do our job, and I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hornstein, seeing that Congress is right behind us, I think we want to I don't want to keep cutting people off. So what we're going to do is recess and reconvene at 6 o'clock
here in the basement.
Okay. Here in the basement. Is that okay with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Members, this meeting is in recess. Welcome back to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. We will start up since we were in recess, and in respect of everyone who is here on time, we will continue to go. We were on testifiers, and
thank you.
Let's see who. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Kathy Velasquez Everhart. I'm here on behalf of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, and I want to thank you all for coming back so that we could have this important conversation. So, Representative Kelly and Representative Hornstein, thank you for your leadership on this. Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, as I mentioned, is an all-volunteer group, and I'm here to kind of bring the voice of the citizens that are living near the rails in these areas and to include a bit of our story about how that is and how, the risks that we're bearing. Our group includes folks that are homeowners living near the rails, but we also have a fairly rich group of experienced folks who are industrial risk manager. We have someone from the Department of Defense who is emergency planner. We have a veteran locomotive engineer and union officer that worked with the railroads, policy analysts, teachers, healthcare professionals, and so forth. Mostly, though, we're folks that live near these tracks and are concerned about the risks that we're bearing and the risks that are happening in our community. As I personally am a business owner, I live in the Como Park neighborhood, and we actually use trains for transporting our product. But I want to be clear that when we started to see the trains coming through our community in Como Park, and I live surrounded by a couple of tracks, and we started to see the large oil trains coming through and seeing them explode in other areas, we realized that that was a risk that was starting to become concerning. These are trains going past our homes, our backyards, playgrounds, neighborhood schools, senior centers, daycares, and so forth. So all of the things that we care for the most, and as these explosions and derailments happen elsewhere, we are concerned naturally. We are here in support of this legislation, feeling that these are common sense ways that we can improve the safety, the transparency, and the accountability of our railroad system. This is not just a problem for those of us who live near these tracks, but it is really for all Minnesotans who would need to pay the bill in case of a disaster. It would these trains go over drinking water in many cases. That would be very devastating if there was a tragic accident. They go past public amenities, sports facilities, hospitals, universities. So all of that is potentially very risky, that could have a large impact on not just the 326,000 people that live along the tracks, but all of Minnesota. This legislation, as I said, has been reviewed and informed by people who are really quite knowledgeable about federal policy and how this impacts this. And these are things that are possible on the state level, and we really feel important that we can take these actions at this moment, and it will make a big difference for the safety and the transparency in our communities. As you'll hear from my colleague next, there are regulations at the federal level, but we're quite sure that they're not covering and protecting us appropriately. There was recently a Federal Railroad Administration audit done by the Inspector General that found quite a lot of lacking in the amount of support and protection that we're getting. The recent Federal Transportation Act also has been weakening, not strengthening, these regulations. So finally, and in closing, you'll hear probably from the railroads about how their safety record has improved and that the vast majority of their trains get to the destination. And while I know that there's a relatively small chance that there could be an explosion in my neighborhood, there's still a big chance that this could happen somewhere. It's really kind of dumb luck that it hasn't happened in the Twin Cities. According to the Federal Railroad Administration, there's 10 to 20 crude oil or ethanol derailments a year, and we've really been doing that at pace. Just recently in Callaway, in Brownsville, Watertown, Wisconsin, Alma, Wisconsin, just across the border. And so it is quite likely that we will be facing additional derailments. And so the risk that we're facing with this kind of a catastrophic, potentially catastrophic event changes the equation quite significantly. So I urge you to strongly consider the merits of this bill and to allow some continued discussion on these matters by furthering it forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Who was it?
Kathy Velasquez Eberhardt.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the committee record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Chairman Kelly and representatives. Thank you for returning. Looks like we've lost a few of the community members, but I hope that
they're still coming.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Just done that.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Claire Rubeck. I'm a member of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, which is a grassroots organization that's community-based. And I'd like to acknowledge at least a dozen of our other fellow members that were here this afternoon, and a few were able to return this evening. And there are also almost 200 members who could not join us today, but are interested very much in this legislation. I want to thank you for taking up House File 3698 today. It's an important tool to further the public safety of over 300,000 Minnesotans who live near the 700 miles of railroad track that carry oil trains through our state. In addition to those 700 miles of track, there are 3,700 miles of freight track in Minnesota, where another approximately 3 million people live. And these additional railroad tracks also carry the commodities of our state and of our nation, and some of those materials are also hazardous, such as ethanol and anhydrous ammonia. In January 2015, the Minnesota Department of Public Service released a report on Minnesota's preparedness for an oil transportation incident. And that report identified weaknesses and made suggestions for improvements in the Minnesota system. And one of these suggestions for improving was to increase the connections between the first responders, private companies, and the state agencies. And House File 3698 helps to achieve this. House File 3698 facilitates the exchange of pertinent information between the rail carriers and the emergency managers to practically develop emergency response plans ahead of time. And then also, as we heard in testimony this afternoon, the bill also promotes the sharing of necessary information between rail carriers and first responders real time at the time of a rail incident. In January of 2015, Mr. Sweeney of BNSF pledged to this committee to provide this information, yet to my understanding, that has not yet happened. House File 3698 serves to codify the exchange of this necessary information. The Association of American Railroads reports a 45% accident reduction rate since 2000. Specifically, that accident reduction rate has been flat since 2012. House File 3698 provides for additional rail inspectors, and it's quite possible that these additional certified state rail inspectors could serve to move the dial in reducing accidents, so we can get back on the track of reducing accidents. It's been holding flat since 2012. Other reasons for increasing the number of state rail inspectors is that many of the rail track cars are being stored on the tracks and in the rail yards, and some of these rail tank cars are filled with Bakken oil, and that's a function of the current market environment for the Bakken oil. And a lot of the typical storage locations for the oil are reaching capacity, and so this is a new alternative for storing oil. So it's another reason, I think, that we need eyes on the ground and additional certified state inspectors. House File 3698 does not impede the federal regulations or recent FAST Act 2015 measures. Specifically, Section 7302, which talks to real-time emergency response information, will only apply to Class 1 railroads. And regulations have not been issued at this time,
and an implementation date is not yet set. Section 7303, emergency response, is simply calling for a study to determine the weaknesses, which is what we're here to talk about today. The weaknesses in response information carried by train crews in 1 year. The study is called for to be done in 1 year. And there's no specification of regulations associated with that at this time. Section 7310, hazardous materials by rail, is a liability study that's being called for. And again, no specific regulations are set to be issued at this time. And lastly, Section 11405 of the FAST Act of 2015 addresses bridge inspection reports. And these will be reports that are provided at the request of a state agent or municipal agency. But these reports are intended to be released in a public format, so highly redacted and not necessarily providing the necessary information that our first responders would require. In closing, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and for you listening to our concerns, especially when it's a bonding year and not a lot of time is allowed for policy. So it's important, and I appreciate your making the time for this. Recently, the Star Tribune editorial expressed about this bill that it provides a sensible information sharing request tool while managing the industry, meaning the rail industry's concerns about its proprietary information. Lives may be saved by codifying, lives may be saved by carefully striking this balance. I hope you'll sincerely consider this bill before you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Sarah Erickson on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Rail Association. First of all, I'd like to start off by saying that there were a number of useful ideas that came to you tonight when the bill was in its original form. And we will continue to work with the author on some of those ideas. As the bill currently stands, there are some provisions that are complicated by the recent passage of the Federal FAST Act, as well as a great deal of industry activity that has taken place over the last couple of years. I've only been lobbying on rail issues for 3 years, and I understand this has been around for 150 years. But I'm hoping that we can soon get to the point beyond the assumption that railroads' first priority isn't safety. We've been willing and continue to have conversations with emergency managers and first responders to ensure that they have all the data they need that we can legally give them and that that data remains secure. In continuing to prioritize safety, we've installed advanced inspection equipment. We are in the process of installing positive train control traction. We have created and implemented the Ask Rail app, which provides first responders in real-time information in the event of an accident. Over 600 first responders in the state of Minnesota have signed up to use this information. We have trained more than 4,000 first responders in the last two years in the state of Minnesota, and we have sent over 150 of those to Pueblo, Colorado for specific training on top of that. The federal government, through its passage of the FAST Act in December, has already addressed a number of issues that still remain in this bill, and will continue to work with the author and figure out those parameters and what that looks like. We will also continue to work with emergency managers and first responders to address their concerns as this bill moves forward, and I'd like to thank the committee for their time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Except you. Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. I am Philip Qualley, State Director for the UT Smart TD Minnesota Railroad Workers. Good evening. I'll be brief. We support House File 3698. We understand there's been an amendment that removes the section for more evacuation drills and practice and stage drills. That does cause us some concern. However, we understand the amendment was necessary. This legislation is necessary due to the lack of actual carry on-property emergency evacuation drills on the CNCP and UP, Canadian National, Canadian Pacific, and Union Pacific properties. The BNSF does perform evacuation drills at Northtown Yard. As reported, various evacuation plan mistakes and failures continue, but we applaud BNSF efforts to continue to try to do on-site evacuation drills. After years of requests from local officers on Canadian Pacific, has now begun drills. As reported, they have not gone well with outcomes that have not been positive, and CP appears to lack the expertise and accountability to improve their yard evacuation protocols. CN Railway refuses to perform periodic yard evacuation drills at their Proctor, Keenan, and Rainier yards. We have had two serious injuries at CN Proctor Yard due to chemical exposure. CN is actually contesting our OSHA complaint under 29 CFR 1910.10M38. CN's position is that other than posting an evacuation drill for yard office buildings, occasional testing of employees on how to use a fire extinguisher, they are under no obligation to perform rail yard evacuation drills. MnOSHA found CN did not post their update nor update their building evacuation postings as required. Our members on Union Pacific Property report that they cannot recall ever performing live yard evacuation drills at St. Paul Yard, Roseport, or Hoffman Yards. We welcome an objective third-party oversight and support from the state of Minnesota to schedule and execute rail yard evacuation drills and incident preparedness. Very quickly, UTU supports top echelon emergency responders receiving this information, hazardous material information. However, we have concerns that information would fall into the hands of the public. We are concerned that with any broad public disclosure of security information regarding the hazardous materials and trains yard trains and yards under our charge. Just very quickly, I want to just point out that when the carriers speak of their cell phone ask rail apps, please be reminded there is no federal regulation or requirement stating the data that going to those apps must be updated and 100% accurate. Even with web-based provision of the data, again, there is no federal regulation. As train crews, we've seen where switching and train assembly errors occur, carrier data processing centers do not update train list errors for the outbound train crew, and lists for the trains that have departed are not correct after the train departs. The carriers are operating at record low operating ratios, and they've cut costs in many areas, including the trained clerical support offices. I want to remind all concerned that under federal regulation, it is only the train crew with the charge of that train that must have the 100% accurate and updated train list with placement of hazmat cars and other train information. In closing, we appreciate all's concerned interest in the subject area and various rail safety legislation that has been introduced this biennium. However, Mr. Chairman, I would be remiss if I did not remind the legislature the best thing the state can do is to assure that all trains continue to have two persons on all trains. At Castleton train derailment, Heimdall, North Dakota train derailment.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Questions for members? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's a question. There's also an irony, and I don't want the irony to go unnoticed, really, as we talk about a rail safety bill. That there's an equally hazardous rail situation as we talk about the Southwest Light Rail corridor, and I think the residents in that area, and I'm sure you perhaps have visited it, Representative Hornstein. I think several of us have. But the co-location of the passenger and freight rail and the freight rail carrying ethanol and other hazardous materials presents a real risk and a real hazard that citizens in the area have made comment about and have tried to get some attention brought to. So it seems to me this is, you know, we shouldn't let it go unnoticed that this plan and the SDEIS is quite flawed and ignores a lot of the reality of what's being proposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rumbach, I agree, and I have submitted some comments to the Metropolitan Council on this very subject, and you know, we have to continue to, I couldn't agree with you more, the supplemental DEIS we were told would address these kinds of issues, and it doesn't adequately, and so we've got to be cognizant of that and continue to press on that. But I do feel that there are provisions in this bill that would apply to not only this corridor, which we have ethanol concerns there and some other hazardous materials, but there's other corridors as well that would really benefit from you know, having this information, having this transparency. We've not been able to get the information we need for our residents from the railroad, and you make an excellent point about the SDEIS.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, it really bears witnessing, because to stand in that corridor and to see that the two trains will be literally, you know, 10 feet apart, 11 feet apart, something like that, and then about that distance from condominiums and residences is really shocking. So I hopefully that can be corrected.
Yeah. Someone else in the audience would like to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Lachelle Sims, 915 Upton Avenue North, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm glad that the lady spoke of the corridors. I am represent North Minneapolis, the Park Minneapolis Park Board, and MICA, Metropolitan Interface Council on Affordable Housing, on their at their CAC meetings. I'm here in regards to a support of the safety of the rail trains. My background, I'm a coal miner's daughter, and the coal mining train ran about less than a space where you are. And back at that time, I was a young girl and didn't know the real hazards of what was in place as we played and et cetera outside. Bringing it forward, my brother worked for Union Carbide for 30-some years. Part of his responsibility was the safety, knowing where these hazardous trains were as it crossed the United States. I also come from Charleston, West Virginia, and at that time, that area was considered the most hazardous city in the across the nation, because Union Carbide, Monsanto, and Dow, I believe, were all by the line in the line along one of the areas up there. In conversations with my brother in regards to the issue, he let me know that not only are the trail of derailments, but also gas leakages that could happen. And once in the air, it's in the air, and there are fatalities regarding that. And I believe a few years ago, there was a gas leakage overseas regarding some hazardous waste. And I want to say India, but not, it may not have been India. But I'm also concerned about, part of my responsibility is keeping up with the various transit systems that come to our town, and specifically working on the Botno Blue Line extension, which runs from North Minneapolis out to Brooklyn Park. And I realize that you all are inheriting various inequities and social justice issues, concerns that have been done in the past. And I guess I'm asking you that as you make your decisions, whatever they may be, that you think of the inequity of these lines going through our community and not knowing various things, where they are and what they're carrying. I realize that there's issues about safety on the rail lines parts, but I still wish you would consider the safety issue, the strong issues that I'm bringing forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anyone else who'd like to testify? Mr. Kearney?
Hi, Bobby Kearney, Jr., registered lobbyist for We the People. I'm glad that Representative Runbeck raised this issue about safety. And in particular with Southwest Light Rail, I want to pose a question to the sponsor here. There's a unique situation there that we have a plan for a tunnel, and it would be about a half mile long. There would be up to two light rail trains in the tunnel, and you
Mr.
would
Kearney,
have...
If you could speak to the
yes.
the bill itself
yes.
on rails.
I'm hitting there.
Okay.
There would be two light rail trains, light rail trains in the tunnel, and a ethanol, Labakan crude trains, a mile long, running over it. And I've run the numbers. You have this Oklahoma City bombing 7,000 pounds of explosives. If you take a one-mile chemical train and put it centered over a tunnel half a mile long, you have 600 times the explosive weight of material on each side of the tunnel that you had in Oklahoma City. And that's liquid. Even if it doesn't explode, it burns and it flows downhill. So the question that I want to pose on this is, how would your bill address this particular danger of a design where you have light rail and passengers in a tunnel beneath chemical trains?
Rep. Sam Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, the bill is really designed to address issues around rail inspections and transparency in terms of what the contents of these materials are and how first responders can respond to a problem. So, I think that we have many different kinds of emergencies that these emergency managers are trained to address. And, I'm sure one of the things, I guess, if my bill can enhance the communication between the railroad that's responsible for this, also the Metropolitan Council and our emergency managers, if that communication can be facilitated by this bill before us, as well as some of the provisions that aren't in here that were dropped that I think are even have more specific communication directives to emergency managers and planners.
Okay.
I think that would address the issue that you're concerned about.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the testifiers for the railroad mentioned something about, I think it was special training at Pueblo, in addition to whatever the folks are doing, wherever they're doing it. What kind of special training is that? Does anybody know that?
I think that's first responder training, but Ms. Erickson, would you like to respond?
Sarah Erickson for the Minnesota Regional Rail Authority. It's just additional hazmat training. It's more specific to any kind of accident that could happen, any kind of spills. They go through tabletop exercises. They go through all different kinds of exercises, and they bring people all over. They bring people in from all over the country to give them advanced training.
Mr. Chairman, is that all the railroads or one of them?
All the railroads.
What do you do? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Ms.
Erickson, how many people would they train during a year, or how many have they trained? Do you have that number?
I don't right now. I think in the last 2 years, maybe 120 from the state of Minnesota, but I can get you that number.
Okay.
For sure.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anyone else here in the audience like to testify on this bill? Okay. Any other questions from members? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hornstein, our fiscal analyst, Mr. Lee, we do have a fiscal note on that you just received, so we'd like to talk about that a little bit since we are the Finance Committee. So.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Lee.
Unfortunately, MnDOT was not able to finish a official fiscal note for the DE3 amendment as amended. However, I do have a fiscal note for the Senate language and from kind of taking chunks that are in the DE3 as amended. Looking at the original fiscal note, the largest fiscal impacts that are still in the language before you relate to two additional rail inspectors, and that the money to pay their salaries and equipment comes from an assessment against railroads, as the current rail inspectors are paid for. So essentially, it's money in, money out. But the estimate for the two additional rail inspectors for the first year that they're on is $326,000, and that includes some overhead, which means buying them new vehicles and training, and then in subsequent years, about $266,000.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Representative Hornstein.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess we'll have to address that in Ways and Means, but, you know, I some direction to the members, and I plead guilty to this, and if this ever comes up for members, both sides of the aisle I'm talking about, you have an oral amendment, run it by Mr. Burris, because I tried to do this on my own, and you know, some of the ways that these bills are written, there's nuances and things that we don't pick up, but Mr. Burris does, and we will have to do one slight tweak to my oral amendment, because, you know, my intention was to add two rail inspectors, as MnDOT has outlined what their responsibilities would be. We're lowering that number. We're still going to lower that number. But the net effect of the way I did the amendment was to only do one. So I think Mr. Burris has better language for this that I'd like the committee to consider, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Burris, proving that he is nonpartisan, we'll walk through that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, the oral amendment that was adopted, as Representative Hornstein noted, my reading is that it would have the result of a net increase of just one rail inspector. And as I understand it, the intent behind the amendment is to have a net result of two additional rail inspectors,
right.
A net of two. So what I would recommend to achieve that would be that the oral amendment be reconsidered and then withdrawn, and a different amendment be orally offered.
Okay. With that, Representative Hornstein withdraws his oral amendment, and we'll ask for reconsideration on a new amendment.
And the oral amendment would be page 1, line 9, delete 9, and insert 6. Again, page 1, line 9, delete 9, and insert 6. And that, Mr. Chair and members, reflects the total number, the high-end optional total number of inspector positions that MnDOT would be able to fill.
Okay. On withdrawing his initial oral amendment, Representative Hornstein now moves the new oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted. Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for your consideration. Thank you for coming back this evening. This is a important start to really looking at the needs of our emergency responders, our firefighters, and citizens that are concerned about this bill and the topic, not concerned about it, that support the bill, but concerned about the topics that are included in it. And I pledge to continue to work with both sides of the aisle. There are some, I think, important conversations that need to continue to take place between first responders and the railroads, and I'm certainly going to be very interested to see the results of those. So I think we've begun an important conversation, and I ask the committee for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And just a note to members, too, we do understand that the first responders and the railroads are going to meet on May 2nd as well.
Correct.
I think Ms. Erickson alluded to this as well, is that I think the railroads have stated many times that they're certainly motivated to have safety first, and that is part of their mission as well. So that is what is going to happen on May 2nd. So with that, Representative Hornstein renews his motion. What's the file number?
3698.
That House File 3698 as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. That motion is approved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you to the first responders, the citizens, the railroads, and everybody that participated today.
Yes, thank you all.
Members, we have up next House File 1780. This bill will be laid over possible inclusion, and with that, Representative Bernardi, welcome to your committee. Please introduce your bill and tell us about it.
Thank you, Chair Petersburg. I am pleased to be here today, and I appreciate all the support that I've gotten from both sides of the aisle on this bill. And again, I'm grateful to be here tonight after three tries, so that's good. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank the Office of Legislative Auditor for the study they did on project selection. That was very helpful, and it's been nice to see some things coming forward that are incorporating some of the information that they learned. This bill right now is a bill, it's a bill that helps a responsibility, I believe it's our responsibility to really invest the resources we have in the state wisely and to make sure that the people of the state of Minnesota are getting a good bang for their buck, and we're creating a system that is great for the future. This really focuses on efficiencies and effectiveness with our resource. I believe also that we need to do oversight. That's our responsibility to make sure that the outcomes, that MnDOT is accountable to the outcomes that they've set forth. We need to clearly link our projects to the goals of the state of Minnesota. So we have great goals in the state, and we want to see that outcome on the projects. This bill enhances MnDOT's performance standards. It focuses on innovation. It also assesses organizational effectiveness. And it bottom line is, when we get new funding in the state of Minnesota, we need to make sure that it's tied to the outcomes of a transportation system that is sustainable and it's a good steward of our dollars. So you can use the word efficiency, effectiveness, and those kinds of things. And it also incorporates the collaboration with the public that is very needed for our transportation system to be a great one. And then in the end of one of these bills, I think it's important that we have actually a professional engineer actually signs off our bill. So there's four parts of this bill, and I consulted with Chair Kelly on how he wanted me to move forward with this. And he wanted me to include all the four components of 1780. And I just also wanted to recognize and mention Representative Nash, Uglum, Representative Whalen, Representative Hausman, Representative Petersburg are all on this bill as well, and you're welcome to join us. So it's kind of, it's fresh. Yeah, go ahead.
I know there are quite a few amendments here. Did you want to address any of those amendments before we get further?
Okay, so you've already moved it for me, and I would like to move Amendment A4.
A4?
Right.
So Representative Bernardi moves A4 as amendment onto File 1780. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Okay, and that amendment is just, there's not very much to it. It updates the dates, and Mr. Burris, if he can confirm that this is the right amendment, that it's updating the dates. It's using a word collaboration rather than consultation, and then it's just taking out just requiring two. It already had two requirements working with Carlson School of Management, the University of Minnesota. We just took out two other requirements of places that they had to work with. So that is the change in the bill. And then I believe we also had a change in the reporting requirement in the assessment regarding some consequences, and we took those out as well. So that's the changes I just wanted to update. Is that what this amendment does? Thank you very much. Okay, so
The rest of the amendments that you have listed, you're not interested in moving forward?
Right. Yep, that's
okay.
It. We can
so,
move forward.
So the bill now is in the form that you would like it, so please go continue.
So I talked with the chair, and I said I'd try to get through as quickly as possible, so I will try to do that. I will touch base on the four areas. One is the performance, stewardship, sustainability, the performance measures. The other two areas that we haven't focused as much on, so I'll just mention them, is the performance targets, that if they weren't met, what some of the consequences would be, and that's something Chair Kelly asked me to retain. The Office of Innovation, Projects, and Asset Management, that he also asked me to retain in this bill for consideration of laying it over. And then the part that I'll talk more about as well is the Enhanced Organizational Effectiveness in Innovation Review. And that right now is sitting in the conference committee and the side-by-side. The Senate has passed very similar language to that. So all in all, the performance measurement part really enhances the performance measurement and standards that MnDOT is using. It focuses on all of our infrastructure. It addresses the inventory, and it puts an analysis on that inventory for the quality of it. It sets a goalpost. It's what a target. What do we want to achieve? And it also provides an important analysis of gaps. Where are gaps? How far are we from our goal, and where did we want to be to provide that analysis? As well as analysis, I think it's really important on the life cycle, other assessments like life cycle of our transportation system. I've shown this before in committee, and you have it in your packet, but right now our transportation system in GASB 34, which we do our bond rating, is based on smoothness. So that's one measurement. I like to think sometimes that we're chasing smoothness, while if you look over on this side, remaining service life, and I know Commissioner Zelli was out in my area and had talked about he's interested in that measure as well, but I don't want to speak for him, but I like that he raised that as an issue. But if you look over here, the remaining smoothness life, the remaining service life that lies underneath the smoothness of our roads in the state, it looks much different. And you'll see a lot more colors of yellow and red and not as much green. This is what the public needs to know. And I believe the public, when they know they realize that our roads are actually crumbling underneath, they'll be more apt to help support investments in our infrastructure. So that is one of the parts of our analysis that we really wanted MnDOT to look up front on the analysis of life cycle and other different assessments. And then get this down to each district. MnDOT, as you know, they have a lot of decentralization, and so each district would have to come up with their plan, and it would be an annual investment plan for each of the 10 years. And then the other thing is that MnDOT, we ought to really look at what the network, what can they actually maintain? Are there things that need to be added to our system and things that need to be removed from our system? So that would also be a part of the report. It would be signed by a professional engineer and submitted to the legislature. So that's the performance measure part. I really feel strongly that if we're going to invest, even if we don't invest more in MnDOT, I think we do need more investments to address our crumbling infrastructure. But when we do that, we need to have really look at reform and getting performance measurements and outcomes tied to the goals of the state of Minnesota on our project. And then the other area I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth, and I think I am going to get within the 10 minutes anyway, my presentation, and that is the innovation and organizational effectiveness assessment. So it would look like things at ratio of employees to supervision. We often hear about the management staff being quite large at MnDOT, so it would look at that. Best practices as compared to other states, appropriate ratio of employees to supervisors, appropriate increase in operations resulting from capital investment. I think that's really important as we, if and when the state of Minnesota goes forward with funding, we'd actually have analysis on what kind of resources are needed to support that in the operations. And then things like fiscal constraints of the trunk highway system and how to achieve the size that would be appropriate that's sustainable in our state. So I just wanted to share a couple of those with you. I'm willing to answer more questions. I know it's late, and so with that is the gist of the bill.
Thank you, and I think there is a sizable fiscal note here that I think Mr. Lee can share some information on that as well, if you'd like to run through that quickly.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets you should have a fiscal note for House File 1780. It may say preliminary on there still. There's MMB just made it the official fiscal note, and I didn't see too many changes from the preliminary, so it should still be the same. But I will note that most of the costs that MnDOT identifies in their fiscal note relate to Section 1, and Section 4. However, they did not estimate Section 2, and I believe Minda could speak to that. So.
I would like to, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead, okay. Representative Minardi.
I would like to comment on the fiscal note is that if it truly does cost this much to do this work, which that's their best estimate, it's like one, and you can help me with this, but it's like one-third of a penny of the cost of our investments of our transportation system. Would that be right, Mr. Lee?
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and members, from the fiscal note, the estimated cost in fiscal year 2017 would be $5.5 million. And if you divide that by the total trunk highway appropriation for MnDOT in fiscal 17 of $1.57 billion, that would be 0.3%.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I may?
Good.
The assessment would cost is estimated to cost $300,000, and that's even a smaller fraction. And I think a lot of times people think that this actually is already something that ought to be done anyway. And so that's my comments on the fiscal note.
Thank you. And Mr. Lee, just a quick question. So does that fiscal note indicate that they are anticipating adding over 21 employees in order to accomplish this?
Mr. Chair and members, that is what it says on the table on page 9 towards the top. However, I will note that it does not estimate FTEs or costs to Section 2 or 3.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This chart that you handed out, I think that one of the things you're asking for appears to be what they're already doing here. But besides that, on the left-hand side, if we take the 2014 pavement conditions statewide and just take the metro area, it looks to me like the metro area is pretty well fair to good, according to the chart. When you look at the other side, the statewide pavement condition remains service-wise. It says low 0 to 3 to moderate 4 to 11 years, which is most of the metro area again. It doesn't seem like those two are matching. We think that fair to good comes out low to moderate. There must be some reason for that. Can you tell us what we're talking about here? Or why?
Representative Minardi?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question. The one on the left side is regarding smoothness. That's how we get our bonding money is based on rated on is based how smooth our transportation system is. And then the other one is one that I added to this, and it's not what is used for the bond rating, but it shows what the remaining service life is on our trunk highway system. And so it is very different than the rating of our smoothness based on the remaining service life of that actual trunk highway portion.
Representative Earhart.
By smoothness, Mr. Chairman, you mean no potholes and no rough spots? Is that what we mean by smooth sailing on the highways? Or
Representative Minardi.
Okay, well, I'm not an engineer. We could probably have an engineer come down and explain that, but this is how the measures that MnDOT uses for smoothness, this is how they would rate their system. So whatever measures that they use, and then that's... They can answer probably further if you want.
Okay.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me one of the things that you're asking for is already being done here. So it's redundant that you ask for the same thing over again, I guess.
Representative Bernard.
Right. MnDOT gets to choose the performance measures in which they want to measure. I'm asking, I showed you this graph because right now this one is being used on smoothness. I'm proposing that the life cycle costs of our roadways need to be factored into their performance and their decision making. So that's why I'm showing this other side. I think it's important that we are addressing that because it's crumbling.
Well, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, you don't think they're factoring the life cycle? I guess you mean whether it's concrete or asphalt we're using. That would be the life cycle decision to be made on whatever part of the road they're working on, depending on the traffic on it. I don't know. Is that what you mean? The length of the road is going to last, life cycle?
Representative Bernardi.
Well, remaining service life, if we could have an engineer come down or somebody explain remaining service life, but it's what MnDOT, and if you could correct me if I'm wrong, but it's what MnDOT is predicting that asset, how much longer that asset's going to last. And so on this, it would say it's going to last. The low would be 0 to 3 more years, moderate 4 to 11 years, or high 12 or more years. That's how long that asset is going to last. I'm getting a nod, so I'm...
Yeah, and if I could just interject here, when you do resurfacing of roads, you aren't changing the base infrastructure underneath, and so you can, for a few years, by putting on additional overlay, you can get a few more years of smooth ride, but the under infrastructure is deteriorating to the point where eventually that will have to be replaced as well. And that's where I think the difference between smooth ride and texture surface quality changes when you look at longevity of life, if that helps any. Mm-hmm. Representative Earhart.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you feel that that's the way MnDOT judges what they're doing here, and that's the explanation for why we have a difference here, that's fine with me.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're getting at what I was thinking about, too, is that if I'm understanding these two maps, the contrast in the two, that it's possible that we're investing a lot of money to assure pavement condition that is needed, which is a short-term fix, which adds, my guess, adds a lot to the cost of maintaining roads, because we don't have the money to do the long-term fixes that are needed in all that red and yellow over on the right. And obviously that's shared by the metropolitan area and rural Minnesota. And so it seems to be these two maps compared to each other suggest to me that we're in a pound, penny-wise, pound foolish, and short-term thinking and long-term problems. And of course, you know what that leads me to conclude. We need a long-term solution with dedicated, constitutionally dedicated money to get at that right side map. So that's would you agree that that's kind of close to where we're at?
Representative Bernardi?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I think this helps to portray what is needed in the state of Minnesota. We do need funding to maintain our infrastructure. And this is a way to tie performance measures to get the outcomes that we want on our transportation system, and helps make it more transparent and accountable to the state of Minnesota.
Any other questions? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify on behalf or against this bill? Mr. Peterson, would you like to come down? go ahead and Bobby, state your name for your record, please.
Bobby Ann Kearney, Jr., registered lobbyist for We the People. I'm really thrilled by this. And to be very frank, I read it quickly. You know, I saw this earlier in the week and saw that everything was pulled except the last section. I'm glad that this additional material is included. I haven't looked through everything, but, you know, both the fiscal note and the overall content of this demonstrate that we're really looking in a serious way and in a comprehensive way at transportation, roads and bridges, and transit. Terrific job. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Peterson. Please state your name and who you represent for the committee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And I would just like to say, first of all, that we are in agreement with many of the things that Representative Bernardi would like to accomplish. And in fact, we have been working on many of these areas for quite some time, and we've made quite a bit of progress. I've been at the department for over 20 years, and I can say that in 20 years we've come a long way. I've also shared some frustration, as she has, with the fact that sometimes we really don't move fast enough. But part of the reason that we don't move fast enough, I'd say number one is, you know, we deal with concrete infrastructure that's in place. It doesn't change overnight. And as we go about our business of improving and maintaining the existing infrastructure, we deal with citizens all over the state of Minnesota that have a wide variety of perspectives that we try to work with them and balance the perspectives and their individual goals and incorporate them and try to make sure that we listen to everybody's perspectives and not just the interests of a few. In fact, when I look around this room and I look at different faces, and I've heard each of you express your opinions at various times during these hearings, and I can say we've got a wide range of perspectives and interests and opinions represented in this room. And that's pretty hard to balance all those out just in this committee room, let alone with the broader spectrum of Minnesotans in across the state. The commissioner has, since I think even before this bill was drafted, has been meeting and working with Representative Bernardi in an effort to try to find a way to find a different way to accomplish some of the things that she's trying to get accomplished. And unfortunately, those talks have not really resulted in much productive output, or else we wouldn't be here talking about this bill, which we have some serious concerns about. The one thing that we do agree with Representative Bernardi on is the Section 4 and the organizational effectiveness review. We think that'd be a good idea, and you know, we're certainly, that's in, as Representative Bernardi indicated, that's in the Senate bill, and we supported its inclusion in that bill as well. So, however, in the other part of the bill, the other sections of the bill that still remain in here, I'd just like to go through some of the items and point out some of the areas where we have some disagreement. And in terms of the remaining service life and the ride, which is the smoothness, just to try to clear up some confusion about that, the remaining service life looks at the structure of the roadway, that is the pavement cracking and the underlying strength of the roadbed that's underneath the pavement. And the ride, or the surface quality, the smoothness, looks at just that, the smoothness of the pavement. MnDOT, every 2 years, drives every mile of road in the state with a van and measures the deflection that occurs when that van travels over the road. And those measurements are used to produce an index number, which is what we use to measure and report on smoothness. And the RSL is more related to, again, the cracks and the things that make the concrete crumble. So with respect to some of the language that's still in the bill, if you look at the first several lines of Section 1, you know, a lot of these things we are currently doing. Right now we produce any number of plans. We have a Minnesota Go 50-year vision. We have our statewide Minnesota multimodal transportation plan. We have a state highway investment plan. We have a freight plan. We have a rail plan. We have a transit plan. We have a bicycle plan. And this would be another plan on top of that. But the point of mentioning all those is that in that family of plans, we actually do measure the quality of our infrastructure. We do identify strategies to preserve and improve it in ways that provide the highest quality possible of transportation services to the public. We use consequential measures to do that. We measure our pavement, as I just mentioned, the two pretty substantial measures of our pavement quality. We look at congestion. We look at safety. Those are our four primary indicators that we look at. So we have measures in place for those, and we have targets for those. Our Towards Zero Death program, which is our primary safety program, is one where we make proactive investments in safety features on our infrastructure that systematically have brought down our fatalities from crashes since it was first implemented around 10 years ago. At that time, we were having over 600 fatalities per year, and our trend was on an increase. So every year before that, we'd had an increase in fatalities. And last year, we actually went up from the year before, where we were under 400 fatalities. The year before and last year, we were up to about 412. So we do have strategies, we do have measures, we do have targets, and we do actually have a record of some accomplishment. And so that plan is produced or updated every 4 years. So we also have district-wide plans for investment in infrastructure, and those plans are incorporated into our 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan. We also have a 10-year investment plan, and then we have a four-year STIP, or what we commonly refer to as our program, which lays out our investment plans for the next 4 years on our state highway system. That those plans are developed in an iterative process. Our central offices that categorize our or do some measurements, our infrastructure, like our bridge infrastructure. They provide condition ratings to the districts. The districts look at those condition ratings and incorporate some of that, the information that they have from their actual experience with the roadway in their district and the bridges. And they work with the central office to identify ways or the most cost-effective ways to bring that infrastructure up to date. Sometimes there are things that they know based upon their experience on the ground that our central office offices don't know based upon just the data that's in the computer. And as a result, they come up with an annual update to our plan, which incorporates new information, but also then continues to bring forward projects we've identified earlier. One of the things that this language would do is would require us to do life cycle risk and health impact assessments for each project in the department. Those would include some of the things we looked at: expected and potential material and energy inputs, including costs; expected and potential material energy outputs, including costs; assessment of the safety, health, economic, social, and environmental impacts associated with the inputs and outputs. Those are things that we don't currently do. I mean, we try to evaluate the types of materials and inputs we use for the kinds of work that we do, but we don't necessarily sit down and do a rigorous evaluation on a project-by-project basis and compare a range of materials. We have our materials lab is constantly looking at different types of material and different types of pavement mixes and construction techniques that produce improved results over time, and we incorporate those when new developments occur. But we don't do it in a systematic project-by-project way in the way that the language seems to require. And we do look at our environmental impacts. I don't think we look at them quite to the detail that many of us would prefer that we do. We have a requirement in statute to minimize our environmental impacts, and you know, those are things that we could certainly improve upon. The project-by-project evaluation that I just described, that's one of the things that really drives the numbers in the fiscal note. So right now we have an investment program called our Corridor Investment Management Strategy, which is called SIM. So it's an internally funded competitive grant program that provides an opportunity for communities to get projects funded that don't score well under our other types of criteria, those four I mentioned: congestion and condition, pavement condition, bridge condition, safety. And some of the things that we evaluate in that program to rate projects, to identify and to award grants, is to look at the impact on the community, the environmental impact, the economic impact. And so we model the impact on the community in terms of traffic impact, safety impacts, and then we use those inputs and we put them into an economic model. And then we try to estimate what the economic impact of those projects are on the local community, and then we use that output to rank projects. And so we're envisioning that something similar to that type of level of effort would be required here. And we have about 300 projects per year that we have in our program, and we think that would cost us about $10,000 a project based upon our experience with that type of evaluation. So it's a pretty substantial undertaking. So with respect to some of the questions about the number of employees that we'd have to hire, I would say that it would be pretty substantial. So the last thing I'll just mention on this section one is looking at the size of the system. I think it was about 2 years ago, MnDOT completed a jurisdictional realignment study which looked at the current trunk highway system and some of the higher level roads that are owned by local road authorities, and did an evaluation. We identified right around 1,000 miles of trunk highway that we think would serve the public better if it were owned by a local road authority, and we also identified some number of miles, which the number escapes me, a smaller number, that would benefit the public more if it was part of the trunk highway system. And how that works is some of the roads over time, their function changes. As the population shift and the local land use changes, they start to perform a different function. Instead of carrying regional traffic, maybe they're more of a local collector or some kind where they're just carrying local residents to nearby businesses or other destinations. And then sometimes the reverse is true when you have an area that grows in population and all of a sudden there are a lot of people who need to get travel longer distances. So regional mobility, that's primarily a function of the trunk highway system. So it's a function that's better served as part of the trunk highway system. So we've done this. We agree this is a good thing and we'd like to do that. Unfortunately, that takes a fair amount of money to get local governments to take over a segment of trunk highway from the State Department of Transportation. We have to pay them. Either we pay them by fixing up their road to what's called a reasonable standard in law, or if the road isn't in need of repair at the moment, we pay them an amount based upon how much wear and tear has actually occurred on the road, and basically how much of the capital value has been consumed before it would need to be upgraded again. And so to do 1,000 miles of roadway, we're talking about a pretty substantial cost. Right now, I know we have an ongoing turnback program. We have a turnback before the legislature this year. We're way oversubscribed to our turnback program. We have quite an extensive backlog. The section 2 that talks about performance achievement acquired, it says that if the department does not achieve the annual performance targets described in subdivision 12, the department shall within 6 months reallocate 20% of all engineering management positions and 20% of all planning management positions to non-management and non-supervisory positions. And first of all, I would just say it's almost impossible for the impact of some of the decisions that our managers make to be evident on the system in a year's time. Again, our system is, the infrastructure is built to last a long time. We update or repair or rehabilitate a relatively small piece of it every year. And so to think that we can turn around and have a significant measurable improvement that can be directly attributable to the performance of a subset of individual managers, I think is very problematic, frankly. And so and without real performance indicators for individual performance, I think it would not only be unfair to these employees, but it would also likely be not a legal personnel management activity. With respect to Section 3, the Office of Innovative Projects and Asset Management, again, I think Mr. Lee mentioned that we didn't estimate a cost for this because the requirements of this office, new office, would be pretty far-reaching. I'm not even going to hazard to even put a range around it. But I would just say that we may not be the most innovative organization in the history of the United States, but in terms of state departments of transportation in the United States, MnDOT is frequently looked to as a place where there is a lot of innovation in how we address the assets that are our responsibility. The what's called the UPA project, the Urban Partnership project, that's 35W in downtown Minneapolis, was selected because it's an example of real innovation in combining highway investment with transit improvements and really kind of innovative approach to managing bus traffic in downtown Minneapolis. Our MinPass lanes, the ones on 35W that were part of the UPA, actually carry almost 1.5 times more lanes worth of people every rush hour than your conventional lane does. And so they're very high performing, and the way that we've done it by not barrier separating them but making them basically only separated by double white stripes, it was an innovative technique at the time. And then the northern part of the northbound section of 35W for that MinPass lane is actually what we call a dynamic shoulder, and most of the time it's just a shoulder. So if you break down, you have room to pull over. But during the peak period when our MinPass lane is in operation, it becomes a travel lane. Our bus shoulder lanes, I think we may have been the first metropolitan area in the country to allow buses, transit buses, to operate on the shoulders of our metro freeway system, and that's been a very cost-effective and very influential part of the Metro Transit mobility strategy, because the buses can actually outperform travel times for people driving by themselves in an automobile. Again, I think we're, if not the first, we're certainly one of the first places in the country to implement that. We now regularly evaluate, we have a complete streets policy, so it's our policy to evaluate the need for all kinds of improvements associated with all users of a system whenever we undertake a project. And this is a relatively new improvement, and I'm sure Representative Bernardi would agree with me on this, that our implementation of that policy is a little spotty at times, but I do think that we're making progress. And our MnRoad, just to highlight one more aspect of the innovation at MnRoad, our MnRoad payment research facility was the first in the country, and we have worked with several countries across the globe in doing live research on different types of payment performance. And I'll just point to one innovation that I think is pretty substantial, but it goes almost completely unnoticed, and that is, for a long time in the history of Minnesota, we put spring load restrictions in place based upon the calendar. And that date on the calendar was identified based upon some average temperature. I'm not exactly sure how, but because of the and the date that they came off was based upon a date on the calendar. But because of the research we did at our MnRoad facility, we were able to identify when the soil temperature conditions were right to put the spring load restrictions on. And what that meant was we didn't put them on a day before they absolutely needed to go on to protect the pavement, so shippers benefited until the load restrictions went on. Then we were also able to tell when we could safely take the load restrictions off. And so we were able to know exactly when they come off so they didn't have to stay on and reduce the loads that were hauled by shippers a day longer than they needed to be to protect the pavement. So I don't know how much we saved over the years from that, but it's been pretty substantial. So not to say that we couldn't do more, but we can always do more, and we're continually trying to do more. But I think that there's a fairly substantial amount of evidence to suggest that we're not just sitting there pointing to, this is always the way we've done things, and that's the way we're going to continue to do things. Certainly we have people who get pretty comfortable in the way they do things, but we push them, and our management team that we have at the department right now, I think, is they're some of the most innovative and creative thinkers that we have. And I just, as I'm sitting here now, I'm thinking of other things. The 35W bridge replacement there, very creative, innovative approach to bridge construction, replace that bridge in a year's time, and I don't think anyone expected that we could do that. Our bridge construction techniques on the St. Croix Bridge, very innovative, very challenging as a result, and I think some of the members of the committee have heard about some of the challenges we've had there, but part of that is because, you know, we didn't shy away from taking on a very difficult task using very innovative construction techniques to do a very difficult job. And then, as I mentioned, Section 4, we don't have any objection to them. With that, I'll just take some questions.
Mr. Peterson, I do have to admit, you represent the department very well with your knowledge and your passion for it. And I don't think anybody around here wants to deny or diminish the innovation that occurs. But you can't use up innovation and hold that up in one hand and then say, but we don't need to improve anywhere else. And so I don't think you're saying that. But we do need to keep it balanced. And if nothing else, I think you're hearing in this bill some frustration with moving things forward and kind of being proactive in the future as well. And what I like to think about is whenever there is an exchange of ideas, if we use it as input and opportunity for us to hear what the others are saying, as a legislature, we're trying to give the department input as well on some of the expectations we have. And the department, who has a large job to do, has their own internal determinations and goals that they're trying to achieve. But if they're achieving something that the legislature isn't interested in or in a different direction, I think that's something for the department to also understand. And I think this is one vehicle, at least, to start that whole process. So, but I thank you for your testimony. Are there other questions of Mr. Peterson or Representative Bernardi? If not, I think we will renew our motion. Yes, Representative Bernardi, if you'd like to comment.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, should I quit while I'm ahead, or should I make comment? Okay, I'll quit while I'm ahead then. Okay, thank you.
With that, this bill will lay over for possible inclusion. And with that, next meeting we will have Monday at a regular time. And with that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.